This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is In Our Time. So where do we learn about technology? Many of us get our information from a technical or a professional association. But not everyone thinks that they should go to such organizations. Many have less formal ways of learning about the latest technological innovations. That is the subject of this podcast, which is entitled Harry and Georgie. Neither Harry nor Georgie is a perfect watchdog. Harry is the more effective of the two, as he's both more cautious and more willing to pick a fight. He once concluded that my nephew was not to be trusted and bit his hand. Nevertheless, Harry is vain, a weakness that apparently besets many a purebred dog. He will look at you and carefully assess whether you are the sort of person who deserves to pat so beautiful a dog as he. If you pass this test, he'll walk quietly to your side and present his head to be scratched. Beggar, friend, murderer, thief, makes no difference. As a trusted one, you have a place in his circle. Georgie gives little evidence of being a good guardian. She'll run across the yard and leap into the arms of any visitor. All the world is her friend, and her friends are rewarded with nothing more severe than a nip on the nose. Occasionally, I've seen her move against an intruder, usually a neighbor's dog, someone that she knows and I thought knew well. Nonetheless, if something goes wrong, she can jump. Harry and Georgie are in the care of Ronnie, a neighbor, who works as a computer security professional for a local information technology firm. As I've come to know him, I've learned that Ronnie works on a different schedule from most of our neighbors. He can be home during the working week, watering his yard and pulling weeds out of the garden. He has spent many evenings, however, away from home while preparing for some deployment of a new system. I've occasionally cared for his dogs when Ronnie has been working nights. On such occasions, Georgie is her delightful self, running from room to room to show how glad she is to see you. Harry, however, will stand vigil by the door, occasionally emitting a muffled woof. He appears to be worrying about Ronnie and wondering if his human companion is doing something wrong. Early in our friendship, I asked Ronnie to describe to me what a security professional might be. He smiled and gave me the definition that I have since learned is common among his friends and compatriots. It's a hacker, he explained, with a mortgage. Unlike most professionals, Ronnie does not belong to an established technical organization. Think about it, he said. It would be like belonging to the National Association of Horse Thieves. Nevertheless, he does attend a regional hackers conference that is called PandaCon. PandaCon is organized by a group of individuals who all seem to possess just a single name. There's one named Snug, another called Stout, a third goes by Bottom, whatever that means, and the fourth is Starveling. All of them look as if they might actually be more comfortable at an association of horse thieves. Some are possessed of long hair, a few of short. A goodly number have none at all. Starveling, who apparently acquired the name as a 13-year-old when he was exploring computerized bulletin boards, occasionally uses the last name of Everyman. I have friends on all sides of the hacker field, he explains. White hats and black hats and gray hats. These terms are commonly used to describe the extent to which a hacker works within the legal community and works without. My black hat friends think I have sold my soul to the devil, he continues. My white hat colleagues think I associate too much with individuals of dubious repute. My feeling is that we should all be friends. Other than the fact that PandaCon meets in a decidedly third-class hotel, it has much in common with other technical events. The meeting that I followed has a plenary section with a speaker of great repute, someone who actually is a fellow of the Computer Society. It has all the other pieces of conferences, breakout tracks, and panel discussions. Beyond the topics under discussion, all of which concerned how to exploit the flaws of commercial software, PandaCon strayed from its more conventional cousins in the exhibit room. In one corner was an arcade game that tests the ability to identify software flaws. You purchase a memory stick to play it, and then you go from machine to test yourself against the other participants. The winning player gets a brand new high-powered gaming computer, The loser gets a panda man, a little fat rubber man that carries a briefcase. Attendees apparently are allowed to hurl their panda mans at any speaker they find boring. The remaining exhibits were perhaps more conventional, but they were also more disturbing. One person was showing how to intercept financial transactions from e-commerce sites. Another had a simple way of stealing domain names that uses well-known public web pages. A third was showing how to reverse engineer programs that use encrypted and obfuscated code. As you walk the room, you feel that you are in the research lab of some nefarious organization that is hell-bent on destroying capitalism or liberal democracy or the entire pantheon of international diplomacy. The last session of the recent PundaCon meeting concerned ethical standards. Snarveling Stug and a couple others sat in the front of the room and tried, as it had before, to define a hacker, to identify the difference between hacking and security work, and finally to describe the ethics of their field. The first subject, the definition of a hacker, was dismissed quite quickly when one speaker described hacking as a form of invention and hackers as the intellectual heirs of those lone inventors who labored for centuries in workshops and basements. The ordinary individual looks at computing technology and asks what it does, the speaker explained. You, the hacker, look at it and ask, what can I do with it? The audience generally accepted the notion that they were inventors, but they were not as willing to settle on any common criteria that separated security professionals from hackers or defined an ethical standard. The discussion started on an awkward note and quickly moved out of control. The first speaker drew the wrath of the women in the audience by saying that he always identified himself as a hacker because, he said, hackers are more attractive to girls. From the start, the temperature of the room rose as the participants realized that the distinction between the two job titles was somehow to be found in the motive of the worker, and hence in the definition of the word good. A speaker of utilitarian bent drilled the room into uncomprehending silence as he attempted to connect the best accomplishment of security professionals with the work that he was doing as a volunteer aid worker intending to the displaced families in Burkina Faso. Another, who apparently had not learned the dangers of relativism, became a target of a volley of panda men when he attempted to find a good motive in the individual who had recently attacked Estonia's information infrastructure. This abruptly changed when one of the audience members complained, anything can be torqued any way. It can be used to help or to hurt. Nothing, said the bard, is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Starveling used the moment to refocus the discussion. How many of you, he asked, do forensic work? How many of you look at the contents of memory to see if a program has violated a computer? Over the course of 10 or maybe 15 seconds, most of the people in the room raised their hands. After looking at the group, Starveling then asked, how many of you are licensed private investigators? At this point, most of the hands dropped. More than a few people looked puzzled. Starveling counted a half dozen arms in the air and then said, this is the number of people who can work next month. The state has a new law that forbids you from earning money by doing computer forensics unless you have a private investigator certificate. Already warmed for an argument, the crowd reacted in anger. Person after person took the microphone to denounce such regulations. They complained about government interference, expounded about professionals defending their own position in society, and complained about organizations excluding the most qualified individuals, individuals such as themselves, who are willing to serve society from doing some useful task. I could have offered the observation that their points were not new. The 19th century sociologist Herbert Spencer noted that professional classes often protect their position by promoting restrictive laws and educational requirements. However, I was not in the position to say much, and in a rare moment of self-knowledge, I recognized that my comments were a little too intellectual and a little too snotty to do any good. The audience soon grew tired of arguing and departed for the conference next stage, which I believe involved drinking. But before they left the room, a young woman made a point that was far more effective than the one I ever would have made. "The trouble is," she said, "we have no one to make our case. We have no one to take our side. We have no one to stand up for us." This statement drew little attention, as the participants were far more interested in beer than in discussing anything further. But it got at the key issue of a profession. Professions are defined by professional societies, organizations devoted to protecting and to promoting certain knowledge or certain activities. These societies codify the skills and education required to join the profession, and they identify the actions and behaviors appropriate within that profession. When members of the society feel that the profession is in danger, they stand up for it. They take action to protect it. Sometimes this work is done explicitly through rules and standards. Sometimes it is done implicitly. For most of their existence, the computing professional societies have behaved more like Ronnie's dog, Georgie, than like Harry. They're glad to see you at the door, they leap into your arms when you join them, and they lick your nose. However, they've rarely enforced educational requirements on those who wish to call themselves computer professionals. They feel if you can do the work, then you are a computer professional. Pundacon is this way entirely. To get into the conference, you need only show that you know how to exploit software and that your credit card has enough space on it to charge the entrance fee. Most attendees have never attended college. Computing professional organizations have wielded their power by defining their discipline through publications and through standards. They identify questions that are appropriate for study and define a class of answers that are acceptable as a means of expanding the field. Perhaps more like Harry in this case, they observe you closely to see if you do the sort of work they believe to be related to computer science. Rich or poor, honest or not, good or bad, if your work meets their standards, they'll let you publish. The problem of ethics became difficult once workers beyond the original core professions tried to claim the mantle of self-regulated activities. The work of priests and lawyers and even doctors has been, at least at different times, fundamentally connected with the principles of civilized behavior, and hence it has been more amenable to ethical definitions. Scientific societies, especially those associated with engineering, have found the task of defining what is good to be much harder. Members of such societies are required to perform two roles, as noted a pair of recent commentators on professional ethics. One of these roles is the responsible professional whose loyalty is to the standards of the profession, and the other is the responsible employee who is loyal to the organization. They also noted that these two sides are further confused by the introduction of government regulation. A major computer societies have made valiant efforts to create ethical codes that are both meaningful and practicable. The IEEE Computer Society of Code of Ethics includes the statement that the computer professional should not put self-interest, the interests of an employer, the interests of a client, or even the interests of a user ahead of the public's interest. It's a strong statement, one that demands the wisdom of Solomon to divide the interest of a client from the interest of a public, but still, ethical behavior is not always easy to implement, and it certainly is not always profitable. The existing codes of ethics do give us a little guidance in dividing the role of hacker from the security professional. They also give a little support to those individuals who are trying to redeem the work of the computer security professionals by volunteering in Burkina Faso. According to the IEEE, software engineers shall donate professional skills to good causes when the opportunity arises. However, not everyone has the opportunity to do such service in a distant land, and, as many argued at Pundacon, most security professionals feel that their work is service. "We do free R&D for software vendors," claimed one. "We hold firms accountable," said another. We do work that could never be done by government regulations, added a third. Such statements were met with general approval, but they left unanswered the claims that have dogged hackers since they moved into public view. The hacking community, for good or for ill, is generally not perceived as inventors publishing in their workshops, but as the kind of romantic outsider, the individual who accomplishes means by working on the edge of society and by ignoring the rules. Hackers do expose software vulnerabilities, but in so doing, they can put the public, at least temporarily, at risk. Hackers have made vendors account for their actions, but in the process, they have occasionally extorted unwarranted concessions from companies. At times, they indeed serve as regulators. But in this role, they are accountable to no one but themselves. Many aspects of human endeavor exist in that gray area between the darkness and the light, and they survive with at least a little controversy. Hacking may occupy a special position because it touches not only on ethical issues, but also on the very nature of computing itself. Modern computing is based on the idea of modifiable code and the widespread distribution of data and services. The implications of an unauthorized modification of a program, or a distribution of code beyond where it should go, are far greater than many older forms of unsocial behavior. Train robbery and horse thievery, though profitable, usually touched only a limited community. In contrast, a self-replicating program can have global consequences. We cannot simply align the world with the values and principles we adhere to prior to the advent of technological challenges, wrote the philosopher Helen Nissenbaum. Instead, we must grapple with the demands that the presence and use of information technology have placed on values and on moral principles. Over the past year or so, both Harry and Georgie have been serving as a watchdog to Brent, Ronnie's new son. I believe that Harry is convinced that Brent is a security risk, for he keeps a careful eye on the boy. Though, of course, he may be just wanting to avoid getting his tail pulled or his ears crunched. Still, he seems to be watchful of the little one. Georgie apparently sees Brent only as another playmate, and she gives little attention to him. Oh, she will lick his face for a moment, especially if he's been eating, but then she'll run off to greet some new friend. For both dogs, the day of reckoning is still a year or two, or maybe three away. Someday, an energetic little Brent will approach the two, leash in hand, face aglow, and ready to take them out on some great adventure. At that point, the two dogs will have to determine if Brent is something good or something bad, something to be trusted and obeyed, or something to be shunned and possibly disciplined. They are, supposedly, professional watchdogs, and that will be their test. You've been listening to In Our Time. This podcast was based on an essay that was published in the July 2008 issue of Computer, which is a publication of the Computer Society. More about Computer and the Computer Society can be found at www.computer.org. To find the information about Computer, click on the Publications tab and then go to Technical Magazines. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at www.computer.org/podcasts. If you have any comments, we'd love to hear them. You can send them to podcasts@computer.org. The music for this podcast came from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network, and you can find it at music.podshow.com. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.